Welcome to Feasting on Design. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. Today on the podcast, I'm talking with Sean Ferguson. We chat about designing for the restaurant industry, how working with the test kitchen has led to him being able to take his creativity in another direction, revising the branding for a restaurant while maintaining the customer's trust. There's a ton of food talk, plus a whole lot more. If you like the podcast and want to help support us, head over to patreon.com/feastingondesign. Every dollar helps us to cover hosting costs, upgrade equipment, and keep the podcast going. When you become a Feasting on Design patron, you'll get access to exciting Feasting on Design news before anyone else, plus stickers and t-shirts. So please help support the podcast by becoming a patron over at patreon.com/feastingondesign. Sean, thanks for joining me tonight.
Jason, thank you for having me. Namaste.
So, this is a replacement episode for an episode that went missing. I'm just going to get that out there right away and be upfront about it. So, let's pretend like I haven't talked to you in a while and catch me up on what you're doing.
I was saddened to hear about that corporate espionage, but you know, Sean Connery and Catherine Zeta-Jones just make a great pair, and I can understand like how they got in and got out with all those files. God, I love that movie. When I was a teenager,
I haven't
like
seen that movie in forever.
The hottest thing ever. I was like Catherine Zeta. No, so I am doing good. I'm working at Chandler Hospitality Group. So we are a regional food and beverage group, and we have a barbecue chain with about 50 to 55 corporate stores and some franchises. We started a burger restaurant this last year in 2018, opened our second location this year, and we've got two or three new concepts in the oven baking right now. And we just brought on our art director, so that'll be a huge help internally for me and the team. And sure. But it's been good. I mean, it's been a solid experience in house on the other side of the agency equation, and I gotta say, I don't miss it anymore.
I can't blame you. I say that as I now run an agency with my wife, but
that's a slightly different agency, though, right?
Yes, it's mine. I'm not beholden to the 80s model of cocaine all day to stay up working all night.
I haven't seen that movie in a while. If you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I not that I've ever done cocaine, but it's just. Want to be real clear about that in case for some. I mean, my mom hasn't listened to one in almost 200 episodes. I don't think she's going to listen, but just in case, Mom, I've never done cocaine.
This is the first one.
even though I worked in restaurants and saw lots of people do it, I myself have never done it, and I am being completely honest.
Well,
you
must have worked in some swanky restaurants. I mean, all the restaurants I ever worked in, it was Mary Jane.
Oh no, there was plenty of that. There was just even the ones I worked in, there were only like two
Those
or
managers
three
just back there like hyping themselves for that shift.
It was one manager and then one kid whose dad was actually, I don't know what it was. He was a sheriff's deputy, but he was the second in charge underneath the actual sheriff.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, I've never understood that. Anyways, to get off on a tangent. I don't blame you for not having the turn and burn as far as agencies go and being able to be in-house. It's a different side of things, and it's. You certainly wear a lot more hats in the in-house world.
Yeah.
But you also have more reasonable hours.
Yeah, I mean, that's the trade-off. I think, you know, there was a huge part of my life when I was in agency, and I don't regret doing it. I mean, I loved every experience and minute, even the negative experiences looking back, I can even appreciate now. But I loved the pace of it and a bit of the grind, and I loved complaining about it. But it also taught me a lot. But man, when you go in-house, yeah, you think you wear hats. But there's two things that I think will give you more hats than anyone can possibly imagine. And one's going in-house, and two is owning your own business. When you own your own business, you wear more hats than anyone on the planet.
Oh, yeah.
It feels like.
I will say now, I complained about it in college when I was, because I was a graphic design major, but I had minors in marketing and communications. And I complained about having to take the damn two accounting classes that to take. But I have used the hell out of them in the past couple months.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've had to get into Skillshare and start learning Microsoft Excel.
In a real way. I still hate Excel.
It's terrible.
I'm very glad for QuickBooks doing the math and having the formulas already laid out for me.
I would kill for that. A lot of times we have a program. It's a back of house program basically that contains all of our data from sales and trends and products and SKUs and all that.
Sure.
And so a lot of times
you can analyze whether the extra spicy sauce targets well in Oklahoma City.
Yeah, where
Lawton.
It sells. Yeah, all that stuff. So it's like it's really useful. So but part of sometimes when you want to like get that out of that program and kind of break it down and add some stuff up real fast or like look for trends across. You have to kind of copy out of that into Excel and start. And man, these dudes in operations, I mean, they, you know, all of them started working in the kitchen or the back house, like washing dishes, you know, and the dudes I work with now, like, I mean, one of them's the CFO, one of them's the VP of operations. I mean, and these dudes are like Excel wizards. I mean, I feel like a total first year Ravenclaw just trying to figure out how I use a spreadsheet. And these guys, you know, who came up old school, they're just like showing me all sorts of crazy stuff I didn't even know you could do.
I thought Ravenclaw was supposed to be the nerdy ones.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean they know everything from the get-go.
I thought Hufflepuff were kind of the dumb, likable ones.
I know Hufflepuff. I try to be humble, but I ain't dumb. I'm not Gryffindor because I'm totally a chicken shit. And Slytherin, man, I just can't do dungeons. That's too damp. No. It wouldn't be good for my sinuses.
Not malevolent enough.
Yeah, but I do like green, so I mean, I could do it for that, but
sure.
Yeah, that's a hard one.
So making the switch into in-house, especially in the hospitality world, what were some of the big, I don't know, unexpected changes that hit you in the face creatively?
Really, like, when I got in, it became more about purpose-driven content and less about concept-driven creative.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think a lot of our systems and a lot of our schools and a lot of our discussions as designers revolve around the idea that concept should drive everything in the design. What is your concept visually, thematically, stylistically? And, you know, I really did buy into that super hard for a really long time. And I still appreciate a good concept. Let me preface this whole spiel with that. I appreciate a great concept when it's executed very well.
Yeah.
That said, the average American consumer, myself included, cares more about the experience they're having than the concept behind your logo or your flyer or your menu or whatever.
Or the Hennessy ad that I just saw that I really thought was going to be a perfume ad.
Yeah, I mean, you can make a thing that is wonderful and conceptual and deep, and you can also make something that gets the job done and sells mm-hmm. what you need to sell in a beautiful manner mm-hmm. and have the exact same amount of impact, or in terms of recall memory, who's going to remember either of those in a year unprompted?
Yeah.
You know, and again, designers, us, we're going to remember that stuff because we're like, that's a great idea. How genius is that? I wish I had come up with that. I'm going to put that in the inspirational spank bank. But, you know, we don't. But the average guest, you know, that comes to a rib crib for barbecue or all you can eat rib night, they don't care. Yeah, they're like, y'all got any ribs? You know, it's 7 o'clock on a Tuesday night and I'm here to smash. Let's do this thing. You know, they want to know that our pit masters, you know, have planned their evening accordingly. They don't care that I've used the same picture 5 or 6 times over the course of the last 4 months. So it was really kind of an education in relearning, again, that purpose versus concept driven. Purpose-driven mm-hmm. versus concept-driven. And I think it has been beneficial to me to learn that. I think that it helps me make decisions faster, and especially in hospitality, as small as we are, and we are really small. I mean, even though we've got a lot of pull in one aspect of our restaurant business, you know, our corporate office is tiny. So if you look at like a Fiesta Brands, right? They own like On the Border, I think. You look at, or it's not Fiesta, they own Taco Cabana, I think. Somebody else owns On the Border. Anyways, it's a conglomerate that owns On the Border. So they got hundreds of millions of dollars, and they plan these things, these limited time offers or LTOs out a year, year and a half in advance, 2 years in advance. And then they start working on it, you know, and R&Ding and doing all the stuff all the way, you know, and then it drops in stores 6 months before it's ever going to, you know, go out. Like they've
got a test market for everything.
Yeah, they've got that going, and we're
special kind of, test kitchens, and
we're scrappy. We've got a test kitchen, but it's, you know, it's just one dude. We got our marketing team, which is, you know, three people, and we have, you know, contractors and vendors, and you know, I've gotten to work with some people that I met at Creative South, which has been great. I've gotten to work with some people that I've had a history with over the last few years now. So in that regard, it's been nice. But I mean, you know, if I get to finish the finish line, you know, 2 months before something drops, I feel great. You know, it's like, oh my God, 60 days.
That's like a huge lead time. Yeah,
it is. It's enormous. You know, I remember, I'm sure you do too, in college when you would get like a design project and do a logo, and they'd give you 4 weeks to make a logo.
Yeah.
you'd agonize over it. You'd work on it. You'd still pull
constantly
all-nighters.
Overthink everything.
And then, you know, now it's like, we're out here in the hustle and bustle. And it's like, hey, we need a logo for this limited time offer that, has to serve to kind of encapsulate everything, but it's also not going to matter because it'll be gone in 4 weeks. Well, you can't spend 4 weeks. Now you spend a day.
Yeah,
making, you know, type lockups, and you might do a micro illustration if it's appropriate, and you know, you fit it in the brand, and you kind of compare and contrast, and you see how the silhouette works, and then you move on. So it's very
utilitarian. You might even have to go out and buy something stock and then slightly modify it.
Oh my gosh, yeah, that happens way more than I thought. And that used to be, and it still is a personal beef of mine. I mean, I've never loved agencies that purchase stock and then change colors. I don't like that. I don't approve it.
Yeah, no.
But I do understand better now the necessity to sometimes I've got to buy a stock option because I don't have the time. Yeah.
You get told the day before scratch. And you already have 50 other things that have to be out.
And you're going to crank it. You're going to go, okay, well, I don't need to spend, you know, 2 hours making a wood pattern. I just need to go spend $30 on Creative Market and buy a pack of 6 wood patterns and make one work.
Yep.
So it's it's literally kind of become an efficiency game. And I think that there's a certain give and take to that, but you know, the upshot is I feel like the things I'm creating now that are in that rush of, I've got to get it done, it's got to make it to market. Like, you know, this menu doesn't have to be the most beautiful thing I've ever made. This logo doesn't have to be the most deep conceptual pentagrammian, you know, gothic masterpiece. It's, you know, those things can be cool and those things can last, but it's cool to have a brainstorm with a team of operators who knows what they're doing, build a menu and have input on that menu in terms of what goes on there, what food is on there, how the experience is plated, how the, you know, the plateware and the silverware and the ambiance and the textures and all that stuff comes together and creates an experience that you can, you know, go to a year later and see that people genuinely enjoy coming to. And it's just like, man, that feeling is just, it's unreal. It's a totally different feeling than, for me at least, and again, this is all me saying this, I'm not trying to project onto everyone else, but for me, that feeling is so much more intense and so much more rewarding than making an animation or a logo that other designers love. I love it when they love it, and I love to talk shop, and I love geeking out over other designer stuff and other illustrator stuff. But when I see people in Tulsa, you know, that I live around, that they don't know me, but I mean, I see them, I know that they're Tulsans, and they're hanging out in our restaurant because it's the place they wanted to go for their birthday, or the place that they wanted to go to for a graduation, or just because they wanted a night out on the town. That feels good, knowing that you built something that people really love.
Yeah. When you came on board and you're kind of learning the ropes of how the in-house side works and how the restaurant business works, what was kind of pivotal moment where things just clicked of how you could create something new without creating a new brand?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I was really fortunate because the agency I had worked at several years ago had Rib Crib as a client. And I had,
so you were familiar with them.
I was familiar with it.
So more than just going in and eating.
Yes. I had been the creative director on that account for the broadcast team.
Okay.
And after a year or so at the agency, they handed me an opportunity, a golden opportunity to kind of help brainstorm a campaign. Mm-hmm. And I did that and I pitched it and I went in, you know, trying to learn everything I could. And then when I was on set, that's when I started talking to the guys at the Crib and building that relationship. And over the next several years, every time we had a shoot that I was directing or I was art directing on or styling or whatever, you know, just that's how agencies go. You wear those million hats.
Sure.
It feels like two on small teams. And I just got to know them. I got to know their preferences. We got to swap in stories and they would give me tips and I would ask their opinions and we would kind of, so then I would go back and when it was time to pitch the next campaign in 3 months, I would pitch things that we had talked about. So there was kind of a shared language there. Mm-hmm. And by the time I left SG, and I kind of came up to Tulsa to join Steelhouse and do the VR thing. Mm-hmm. I didn't think I'd ever be working with them again. So when they reached out to me asking if I knew, you know, they knew I'd moved up there. And after I left SG, they had gone to a new agency in Dallas. And the agency had a lot of food experience, but they were I didn't feel like it was the right fit for them, I think.
Sure.
You know, not that they did like a terrible job or anything like that. It was just, they were in Dallas and this was like their second agency to team up with. And they really wanted somebody local that they could talk to and go see and meet with and, you know, have a relationship with. And I understood that. And this agency had kind of had an opportunity to make a brand for this burger concept and they didn't like it. and they didn't, mm-hmm. And they reached out to me asking if I knew anybody, in that way that you ask if, do you know anyone who would be willing to, I don't know, perhaps make a logo for us? And it was like, oh yeah, of course.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Yeah, I would be happy to. And, it just goes to show that you know, this is a prime example. We always talk about don't undervalue, don't undervalue, don't undervalue. But I took a page out of Draplin's book where it was like he always talks about sometimes you just got to do a favor for a friend. Sometimes you just got to hook somebody up. Mm-hmm. And so I said, sure, what's the budget? And they're like, well, that's the thing. I have like $500 left in my budget. And we all know how much it costs a brand and an agency. It can range between $10,000 and $50,000.
Uh-huh.
And I know what they pay because of that. And so it was like, okay, you have practically nothing. I'll do it. I don't care. I want to do this brand with you. I want to team up. Mm-hmm. And so I went in and I pitched and I built a brand book and I built a pitch deck just like I would for, you know, a $30,000 client. Mm-hmm. Because I was hyped. I was hyped to be working with these dudes again. And, they loved it. And they kept asking me like, well, what do you think about this? What would this look like? What would this look like? And treat this like your brand. I mean, treat it, pretend like this is your restaurant. And I was like, man, this is a lot of authority. But you know, I just clicked real well with everybody. We had very similar taste. And so by the time I came onto Rib Crib about 8 months, let's see, we opened in July of 2018. I joined in like basically Thanksgiving of 2018. So they started hitting me up right after the restaurant opened. And I was like, I don't know. And when I came in, I hit the ground running because mm-hmm. I was very fortunate because I had that shared relationship. And I just kind of rolled back what the other agency had did. I always felt that there was a contrivance and I'm fighting that right now. You know, every barbecue brand uses the same four fonts. And we are currently in that problem right now where Veneer, Nexa Rust Bold, Lobster, House Sampler, you know, kind of make up your grungy. I'm a small town barbecue creative but that other agency had kind of introduced those fonts, those typefaces after they had partnered up. And they'd spent some money. That's the thing. You learn, oh, you've invested money in signage. You invested money in environmental and out of home. And now I can't just flip a switch and you just change everything. That's a significant amount of money.
Yeah. Well, yeah, especially if they had, I mean, I don't know how many restaurants or franchises and restaurants they had at that point, but going off the number you just said, you about said earlier,
same,
about 50, and then you know,
that's a lot of change,
money. Change signage for 50 restaurants, you know, that's hundreds it's of crazy. Thousands of dollars.
It is, it really is, and it's a very huge chunk of change. And so, I looked at the brand and that was where my aha moment was kind of like, okay, I don't need to reinvent the wheel. I need to simplify. I need to bring it back to basics and just roll back the clock. And I'm going to have to keep some things that this other agency did out of necessity. You know, their choices I would not have made, their fonts I do not like using. And I have,
you don't like lobster?
Us off of them, but we still use them in certain places because that was a decision that was made before me that I kind of have to honor. Unlike Rian Johnson, I know how to make a sequel to a Star Wars movie. And so I knew my job.
We won't get in that debate.
Well, my job was to make a tent pole and I went in to make a tent pole. I did not try and subvert anyone's design expectations. Now that doesn't mean that I haven't slowly but surely, with their blessing and help, moved the brand in directions. You know, we got rid of all the super fake parchment textures that I hate. We got rid of all that over leathery, you know, excess of wood texture stuff. I mean, we've just gotten it down to, let's just make it paper. Let's just make it red, black, and white. Let's just get back to basic materials. Typeset it really well. And then on purpose, mess some things up. Don't just buy a textured typeface. You know, and the art director that just joined us, Steven, he, you know, he was like, man, let's go down. I got a hookup. They've got a letterpress. Let's just get like a whole set. Let's get a whole alphabet. Let's make our own typeface, man. Let's just weather some stuff up on our own. And that's the kind of like, you know, assistance I've been craving. So
yeah. And you were like, yes, that's a great idea.
You're the man. No, yeah, but it's like, and it was like, let's do it. But we have to pick things that are similar enough to what exists. So I have to have a condensed sans serif, like veneer. Yep. I have to have a serif. It doesn't have to be Nexa Rust bold, but it has to be chunky like that. Mm-hmm. I have to, but it can't be too Western. It can't be too, you know, wood type.
Yeah.
I have to have some kind of a script or a handwritten font. I'm content to use certain things that we are using now. Lobster, that you know, decision was made when I was at Staple Gun, and I think if you age it and you typeset it appropriately, it can look okay, but everyone's using it now. So it's like you want to use it as little
as possible. It's overused, yeah.
It is, and that's the problem. It became part of our logo when no one was using it, mm-hmm. And years ago, and now – everyone's using it, so I only use it on the logo. I don't use it anywhere else. But mm-hmm. It's kind of like that. Have you seen that somebody did something on Instagram where it was like they took all these Helvetica logos and they were like, what if you couldn't use Helvetica and you had to use Times New Roman? And they retyped them in Times. And it was brilliant because they looked great. And it would kind of reinforce that idea that a lot of times it's not the font, it's how you use the font. So. Yeah. So we're currently looking for some alphabets, some libraries that have similar characteristics that we can kind of go in, ink them up, run them off at different sizes and kind of get some different textures and then build our own over the next year. And we'll slowly swap those out so that then
I know a guy you should talk to about that.
Signage. Yeah. I do too. I think we might know the same guy. He's pretty good at this.
Yeah.
But yeah, but it's like that. It's making those little compromises up front that pave the way for bigger changes that are more subtle, you know, and my hope is in the next year to 2 years, we're not using the same fonts everyone else is. We're using our own flavor that feels similar enough that when you need a refresh, I need a new banner. We're going to redo the restaurant or whatever. Like the other stuff, when we redo it, is not so far off base that if you go 50 miles away,
that it just shocks like somebody. Yeah.
We want it to feel like a family.
Because I think that's the difference between like a tech brand and a restaurant that has an actual physical presence is.
That's a great point.
You know, something that lives solely on the internet or solely on a screen, the investiture and trust that you've put in your clientele, if you rebrand, isn't as jarring. It's not as off-putting. When you do that with a physical brand, people have to completely relearn what it is that they trust about you. Mm-hmm. And they're going with a restaurant, they're going to, you know, their mind's going to go to, oh, they've changed up how we like this, you know, the way that they cook the French fries is just this certain way. They've probably changed that too. It's, it's all these little things down the road. And I'm not saying that should be taken into consideration with a brand that lives out in the ether. Because there are systems in place that people will have to relearn, and you can certainly damage that trust by it. But that cycle that it takes for someone to relearn it when you have a physical aspect versus that ethereal aspect is a completely different monster.
It is. And I mean, you bring up a really good point. I mean, I hadn't really connected those two together till now, but you know, YouTube, Google, YouTube changes their brand and they change their uploader constantly. They're always changing.
There's constant iteration, constant. Yeah.
But as a tech savvy creative, or even as a user, you don't have to be creative. You can just be a YouTube user. You're on that platform for a very specific purpose, and it is the only one of its kind. I'm not saying Vimeo is not a video platform. YouTube is the second largest search engine in the world.
Yep.
It is rapidly becoming the place where people go to search for answers, not just entertainment. And so Vimeo is very much a creative filmmakers, you know, animators. Hey, this is, check out my work. It's very much a Behance style thing. YouTube is for the masses, but if you make content, you understand that those tools are going to keep changing, but you have nowhere else to go, so you're going to relearn it. If you go out to eat and you like how we make our ribs and you like how we cook our French fries and you like the ambiance and then we change it to a new logo, you know, we pull an Olive Garden on you and your logo goes from being this kind of like tastefully tacky logo to this very, I don't even want to call it sleek, like prefab corporate sans serif, like sterile.
Too simplistic and sterile.
Yeah. It was just like you went by no means, like if you had no prior experience with Olive Garden and that was the first time you ever ate there and ever saw that logo, you wouldn't think anything of it. But you see that and you're like, whoa,
I how disagree bad did this with change? You. I think even and this is probably more of a designer conversation, but I think even the masses, they've been conditioned to know what bad design is more than they have what good design is.
Oh, I don't
dispute when you see something that is, because as much as I don't care for the Olive Garden logo because it's just kind of devoid of personality, it's not actually a bad logo.
Well, and that's,
I mean, design wise, it's actually,
I think if you
pretty decent, but it's,
it feels like the difference between, though, like a mom and pop shop has terrible design, absolutely garbage design. And I'm not saying that I'm not saying the Olive Garden is a mom and pop. What I'm saying is, if you had never heard of, eaten at, or seen the Olive Garden before that rebrand, and the first time you saw them was that rebrand, you would think it was a chain. But I'm saying you wouldn't think there was any. You wouldn't be like, oh, did they change something? What happened? Did they?
No,
is it all corporate now? You would just assume this has always been the logo.
The way
Pizza
it is.
Hut changes their logo constantly. Mazio's changes their logo. Taco Bell changes their logo. Olive Garden hadn't changed forever.
You just gave like four that are yum brands.
Right, so, right. And
but Olive Garden's not a yum brand, is it?
I don't think it is.
No, I think it's. I think it's Landor. Not Landor.
I don't remember who owns it, but the idea,
I'm going to remember the minute we get off the phone or get off.
You should. Yeah. We'll add that in. But the idea is that Olive Garden hadn't changed in so long and that you grew, it became part of your landscape and it was this quote Tuscan rustic blah, 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 blah.
Well, and they invested.
It wasn't a great logo. It was never a great logo.
No, but they invested a lot of messaging in reinforcing that.
It grew to represent the experience they wanted you to feel. And then all of a sudden it became a no personality, not terrible, just very lacking in personality, sterile corporate logo that everyone's into now, which is like super sans serif, very sleek, very minimal. But it didn't say Olive Garden in a way that people had been relating to for the last 20 years. Little Caesars, on the other hand, brilliant rebrand.
Yeah, you can barely tell a difference if you don't.
They just tightened it up.
If you put the logos side by side, you can see a vast difference as a designer.
Exactly. But if you just saw it and then the next day the rebrand came out and you know you went to go get another pizza or whatever, you're like, oh, this seems new and cleaner. Like the store and the box seems different. I'm not sure what it is, but it feels the same. It's not super drastic. So they don't suddenly question, have you changed everything? Have you sold to a new company? Are you going out of business? What's going on? So I think that's the, I think we're saying the same thing. I think that
I think we are too.
It's that Olive Garden had a tacky, in a kind of 80s, delightfully tacky way logo that I have a nostalgic attachment to, but only because I remember it as a child.
Yes. And but I also think it was such a, like you said, delightfully tacky logo.
It's a bad logo.
People who aren't designers were conditioned to equate it with homegrown Italian, rustic.
Correct.
They're more focused on what their food is than what this looks like.
Correct. And that's what they did. But then they made that logo that was such a drastic change. Mm-hmm. But the messaging really didn't change to reflect.
No, the messaging didn't change at all. They were still pushing that our when chefs you're here, train
your family and our
our chefs train in Tuscan kitchens.
But that's the challenge.
I mean, I didn't work in an Olive Garden, but I had a roommate in college who worked at an Olive Garden.
Yeah,
they didn't send those people to Tuscany.
I can tell you, I make training videos for barbecue craftsmen, and that's. You know, they're watching YouTube just like the rest of us when you make these videos for them, and they read a handbook and they like may go to like some training, but it's not in Tuscany. But
now the chief executive chef in charge of whatever at Olive Garden
did study in Tuscany.
Probably took a vacation to Tuscany.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a competitor because I say competitor. There's a player in the barbecue space called Famous Dave's. You've probably heard of it.
I'm aware of Famous Dave's,
They're, quote, pitmaster. National pitmaster is a guy named Travis Clark from my hometown, Yukon, Oklahoma. He's a national barbecue champion. I mean, he's won the Jack Daniel World Invitational. This dude has won the Royale. I mean, he's just crushes on competitions. But he's the national pitmaster for Famous Dave's. But I can promise you that all of the guys working at Famous Dave's have not competed, just like all the guys that work at a Rip Crib have not competed.
Yeah.
We have GMs that compete. We have, you know, some of our back of house guys do, but you know, it's not like
few and far between.
We try really hard to separate, not do the Olive Garden mistake of we take everyone to Tuscany and they learn the sauce and then they do the thing. It's like, no, come on, man. It's all real, but they kept that messaging, but the drastic visual change and the visual change to me looked like Mazzia's.
Tuscan sun messaging.
Yeah. It just didn't fit. It just didn't fit. It was weird. But Taco Bell, I think has done a good job over the years. I think they've gotten a little too sterile and they kind of backed up a bit.
Yeah.
Pizza Hut has kind of backed up a bit to get a little closer back to their 80s chunky kind of look. It looks like, and I kind of dig that. So I think restaurant brands can be flexible, but you have to look at scale. You have to look at assets, and you have to look at how do the old ones fit into that restaurant. And what worked with Pizza Hut is all those buildings have that distinct shape.
Yep.
So like, even if their logo, if you're a franchisee and you don't want to update your logo or you can't afford to or whatever, you're still getting the benefit of the shape of your building and the words Pizza Hut, and it just becomes part of the landscape because they're everywhere. There's thousands of Pizza Huts.
I can't remember the exact name of it, but there's a website and I heard this on the 99% Invisible podcast too. There's a website that think it's like this used to be a pizzahut.com or something like that.
Oh, that's a,
and it just goes through and takes pictures of all of these places that,
they've become like sushi restaurants and like Chinese restaurants and barbecue restaurants. And I mean, actually, one of our restaurants used to be a Pizza Hut.
Nice.
So I think, you know, everyone's got one. It's either Pizza Hut or Amazio's. They both kind of had that similar.
Yeah, very similar
style for a hot minute. It might have been Amazio's. This is Oklahoma. That would make more sense. Oh, man, that's so crazy. I could talk restaurants all day.
Well, we can do that next time. But so as you're coming on board and working with the Rib Shack thing, simultaneously, you've been developing this burger concept place. How are you? Are you associating the brands together where people know that, hey, from the people who brought you Rib Crib.
Yeah. One of the things we kind of worked on was at the beginning, obviously Rib Crib's kind of spread across multiple markets. And so in the Tulsa market, the love is very strong for the Crib. In the Oklahoma City market, they don't know us as well. You know, there's fewer stores there. The corporate presence isn't there. So we're not local to them. We're just another restaurant. And so for us, at first we wanted to, kind of get society up and running on its own steam. mm-hmm. and then see how people reacted to it before we kind of brought Rip Crib into the play. That's not to say that we didn't have it out there. I mean, it was definitely a Chandler Hospitality concept. And, you know, and if you wanted to put two and two together, it was very much out there in the open. But we kind of let them live on their own. Society is a little more highbrow in a experiential kind of way. Like it's that, you know, you can come however you want. You can dress whatever you want to wear, flip flops and cargo shorts and a tank top. And you might sit next to a dude wearing $1,000 suit and you're both chowing mm-hmm. down on a hamburger. And the idea was that, you know, we all love a good hamburger and it doesn't matter who you
are.
One
of my favorite foods.
And there, this is a place for everyone to come get one, the best hamburger, we could make. And
sure.
And I'd put it up against anybody. I love our burgers. It was before I even worked there, I was adamant that it had to be awesome or I didn't want to work on it. And so, you know, we wanted it to grow on its own. But now that it's kind of gotten into its second store and we've got a third store coming, mm-hmm. Hopefully sometime in 2020, you know, I think people have the connection, but a lot of people don't realize that one is owned by the other. And we're not really leveraging that name
sure.
for this concept. We might leverage it for a concept that's coming because it's a little more in line with the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
So the audience or the demographic, I guess, rather at Rib Crib, is probably 30 to 60 is our
sure.
sweet spot. So really like late, or I guess early millennials, Gen Xers, and then late boomers is kind of our sweet spot. You know, you might have some younger mm-hmm. kids. You want to feed the whole family. You may want barbecue, but you don't have the time or the money to go to a tourist spot like, you know, Franklin or Burnco, which has a line out
sure.
the door for 2 hours. You want to eat and get home. So that's kind of our sweet spot. Society has a much wider range where we're getting down into like, you know, Gen Z teenagers all the way up to, you know, boomers who are just looking to have a good time with the cool kids, so that the audiences don't really sync up as well. So we don't talk about it as much, but
sure.
We're not ashamed of it at all. But with some of the new concepts coming up where the audiences line up better,
but the positioning strategy is very different.
Absolutely.
Because they're very different. Yeah.
Rib Crib's going to be definitely putting some wind in the sails for, you know, one of these concepts coming out. And mm-hmm. I think Society will also put some wind in the sails. So we just, you know, we're kind of plotting it out, but, being patient.
Sure.
Rather, I think when we get to Hal Smith size, where we've built like, you know, 18 concepts with 10 restaurants apiece, I think then it'll be kind of a thing where from the people who brought you these 18 concepts, it's another great thing.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, when you're rolling things out, and since there are franchisees on the creative end, how do you ensure that stuff is getting implemented properly?
Not on
the food
question.
End.
Yeah, I don't know. Well,
because I know that there, I mean, that does well.
The food is really the most important part in my opinion.
And yes, it is.
When we, so it just depends on your franchise agreement. So
sure.
If you are one of our
general broad strokes,
right. If you're one of our franchisees and you were to invest and purchase your own Rib Crib, you can pretty much carte blanche. This agreement was made pre-marketing, pre-anything years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You can pretty much do whatever you want. And there is a system in place where part of your agreement is that, you know, we give you materials that you can use. But if you want to, like, make your own TV, you want to make your own radio, mm-hmm. you're free to do so. And most franchisees don't do that because – it's
that costs them more money
and they already get this stuff for free and they get the lift from being more brand centric. And so
sure.
they, you know, there's a lot of reasons for them not to do that. However, we do have franchisees who elect to do extra on top because they want the lift. So they may do their own radio. They may do things, media that we're not supporting in that region. Because when I look at a DMA and decide, is it worth spending the media dollars here to get the lift at these stores, and it may not, you know, I may have to pick the two or three biggest for my bang buck markets, mm-hmm. and market number four might have franchisees who decide to do their own. And some of these franchisees own multiple units. So, generally speaking, if I give them the materials, they stick to it pretty well because mm-hmm. they don't really want to change anything. If they make it themselves, I have seen some interesting things. But I always come back to, if the food is quality and the restaurant's clean and the experience is consistent, mm-hmm. you know, this top of funnel stuff that we're doing to just get people's attention, you know, it kind of falls away, as long as that bottom of the funnel where the food and the experience connect with the guest, as long as that's consistent, I think the brand is safe. So, mm-hmm. But again, you know, there are franchisees who don't always update the menu to match what we're doing, and they prefer doing things the way they did it 15 years ago when they bought the franchise, and they're still doing it that way. And they're a lone wolf, and that's entirely their prerogative. And it's an interesting experience kind of fielding some of those guests' feedback sometimes. But it's instructional too. I mean, I learn a lot from how to kind of navigate some of those situations.
Sure. Well, especially with franchisees, you've got, I mean, no matter where you work, you've always got a lot of different personalities, but.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
The personalities that you have to deal with franchisees have a financial stake in.
Absolutely.
And what's going on there. So
they've you know, bought into your vision.
You may have to listen to them a little harder.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, we've got a really great franchise liaison, that he's a employee of ours. He's a Chandler Hospitality employee, but he runs several of our Rip Crib restaurants in Oklahoma City and some of the other areas surrounding, but he also is the franchise liaison, and he has a great relationship with all of them. But, you know, he talks to them on the regular, and they have suggestions, and they have good suggestions sometimes. And mm-hmm. you don't want to not listen because you think you know better. I mean,
sure.
And these folks have bought into your vision, but they are here to make money. And some of them run other restaurants, not just your restaurants. They own mm-hmm. other brands, and they may learn things that you wouldn't have access to. So it behooves you to learn how to listen
sure.
to these folks.
One thing you touched on when we were talking about this was, you know, how the food ties in to the creative and things like that. When it comes to tying guest experience in a holistic manner, you've got to take the food into account. How do you work with that team to develop a game plan and a path forward?
So when we're working on the food, a lot of times we start with what would be really tasty or what would feel good this month. What's something new that people would come in the door, and, you know, well, I'll use a past example, so that way I don't give anything away and get in trouble.
Sure. Keep your job, by all means.
We did keep your job. Yeah, enjoy it. So let's see. So I'll just use the most recent one, Porkapalooza. So we did the VP of administration / marketing had come to me while we were planning 2019 back in November 2018. Mm-hmm. And he said, man, we did this pork promotion like 10 years ago called Porkapalooza. And we did like these tie-dye t-shirts, and it was just crazy cool. And I would love to do it again. And I said, all right. I mean, I don't have a problem with that. Like, at this point, nothing's off the table. Let's put it on the calendar and kind of talk through it and brainstorm what some of that could be. So I put it on the calendar, and I started digging around, and the marketing director went and found me some of the original creative from back then, and mm-hmm. the original logo. And so we kind of riffed on that. And then we kind of set it aside for a couple of months. it was still on the calendar as, you know, September Porkapalooza, and it was just going to be a pork driven LTO. So, you know, and of course, pork is a big part of barbecue.
Sure.
And so maybe about June,
depending on what part of the country you're in.
Sometimes absolutely.
The most important part.
And surprisingly, when we started Rib Crib, as I'm now using the Royal We, when we started Rib Crib, pork wasn't actually part of our menu because we were in Oklahoma.
Yeah, I was about
and
to say.
And when we actually opened a location or two up in Florida, and people were like, where's the pork? And we were like, so, you know, we had to kind of like add that to the menu and learn real quick. Now it's one of our staples. I mean, we have a pretty solid pulled pork. But for Porkapalooza, one of the things we did was around June, our executive chef and I and the VP of Ops and Director of Special Projects and VP of Administration / Marketing, we kind of sat down and just started bullshitting. Man, what would be tasty? And sometimes these meetings happen like at 5:30, right? As everyone's leaving, we're just now starting to like chat. Like we've been working all day now. We're like, hey, I was thinking earlier, and what if we blah, 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 blah. And so we just start playing and it's just a fun conversation. We start, you know, we collect all this inspiration from everywhere, Instagram, cooking blogs, forums, and road trips or vacations we took. And we ended up doing a sliced pork shoulder combo. We did a rib combo. We used one of our classic combos called the Dirty Deed, which is pulled pork, a Polish sausage, and a St. Louis rib. Mm-hmm. We did a Tennessee pork sandwich. I think we called it a Memphis pork stack, and it was pulled pork, Tennessee red vinegar sauce, bread and butter pickles, red onions on a bun. That was incredible. Mm-hmm. We did pork egg rolls. I mean, it was just like, how can we make barbecue engaging and different in a way that appeals to families? Because I think we're a family concept. You know, we started as a shack, but when you get to 55 locations and you're, you know, you're trying to please a family and you're not a tourist spot anymore, you know, you got to kind of look at who you're competing with, like your Cracker Barrels and your, suddenly my mind went blank. It's a catfish place that always pops up wherever we are and I can't remember it.
I have no idea. I can't think of a chain catfish place. So.
It is. We just, you know, we're trying to play around with it. So we play and I'll throw stuff out and they'll throw stuff out. And then, you know, the executive chef goes in the kitchen and he starts playing. And over the next couple of weeks, we start going in the kitchen and eating. And then there's a real discussion. This is too tangy. This is too salty. This is too sweet. This is a gross texture. Why did you make this? God must hate you. have you considered making it hotter? Like, what kind of bun could we do? I hate these pickles. And there's just this fun back and forth and trying things and kind of landing on that menu. And, you know, we had kind of rushed through that part a couple times early in the year. So we really kind of took our time and man, that sliced pork was awesome. And I'd never had it. I mean, I had no idea that it was a popular thing in the Southeast to get sliced pork shoulder. And, you know, so I made a special point when I came down for Creative South last time. To kind of
go seek that out
and see if it was real. And, you know, I found a couple places serving sliced pork. So I was kind of blown away at how easy it was. And so it's just it just starts off as some dudes who would genuinely enjoy working with each other, shooting the shit, you know, and we'll go ask some of the ladies in the office, like if they like this or that, because, you know, a bunch of our audience is actually ladies. They're women. I think it's 54%. And we'll get them in the test kitchen and they'll throw out ideas. And I mean, it's a fun process to get it to where you think you've got the menu and then you have everyone test, you have regular people test it at that point.
Yeah.
And see how well you do. And then, you know, we kind of take bets on what we think is going to sell real well. Street tacos are always popular. That sliced pork ended up crushing. I mean, we just weren't sure, you know, it was a new product. No one had done it before in Oklahoma that we were aware of. And we weren't sure if it would be easy or hard for our guys. So we had to work extra hard to make sure that they got the training materials to do it right.
When you do it, do you roll it out to like one restaurant to kind of test how it's going to do in the market and stuff?
We pick, excuse me, I'm so sorry for that. We have some test stores. We pick four or five stores, and we try and pick different demographics that kind of go to that store.
Sure.
Economic ranges and, you know, a bunch of middle class rooftops. And we pick like a more rural area where like that's one of the only restaurants out there. And we pick our busiest, you know, we pick different regions to get a good spread of our who our guests are. And then they go into test mode. And for the next 2 weeks, you know, sometimes it's 1 week, but we've been getting longer. They get a chance to kind of chalkboard it. And we'll do some targeted ads to tell people like, hey, if you go to your rib crib at this address, you can try a brand new menu that we're thinking about rolling out. We get good guest feedback that way. And the operators can help us kind of smooth out any kinks in the system or, you know, the line flow, you know, when we're building stuff. So it's really beneficial in that regard to kind of get it out there for them to try out. But, you know, we don't always get to do that. Sometimes we hit the ground running and we hit a winner and we're just like, all right, it's going out. And then you get the training materials in their hands and they start working on it and then we roll it out.
Now that you've got, and I know you just brought him on board, but you've got an actual, another art director on board other than just yourself. You know, what are some of the things that obviously that you can talk about that you're looking forward to, accomplishing?
Well, some of the stuff I'm looking forward to is the help with building the additional brands that we've got coming. Additionally, being able to hand creative duties I trust to this person, to the art director, and be able to say, hey, you know, I've got my hands full with the strategic stuff. You know, I need you to jump in and do this and then know that it's going to get done to satisfaction. So I was very ecstatic about that, but also having that creative collaboration again in the four walls. I mean, again, I work with an incredible team of people who have so much experience in restaurants and hospitality. But you know, very little experience in photography or shooting video or editing. And so, you know, when we shoot training videos and I sync up an audio track in 5 minutes and they're kind of, you can do that? Yeah. Just a button right here. And it would take them all day because they're sitting there trying to line up the WAV files. You know, so it's just a matter of, you know, we all have our strengths and, but it'll be nice. We just actually did a shoot yesterday to finish shooting the rest of a menu for an online ordering system we're building. And it was wonderful. It was wonderful to have that person who, when you said, all right, I'm going to do this, will you like take the picture and like kind of tweeze it in the Lightroom, you know, while we're kind of, so we can review it. And he knew exactly what needed to be done. And he looked at it, he made some judgment calls and then it was like, oh yes. You know,
we've added a little more gloss on the sauce over here.
Yeah. And you just
make the bun not quite as shiny.
You kind of, can you hand me the, and they just know because they've been in those situations.
Yeah.
And so but I'm looking forward to, you know, more collaboration, coming up with more original, more diverse content. You know, we're hoping to get a little more educational this year. We're hoping to really utilize YouTube this year.
Oh, cool.
And creating stuff that people want to watch, not just commercials, but like gear reviews, how to's, backyard tips, how do you make the perfect char burger? You know, let's talk about the difference between a Kamado style smoker and a Weber kettle. And like, you know, these are the two you might see at Ace Hardware. What are they both good for? And just kind of trying to speak to our audience in a way that
is a Weber gas grill really better than a?
Yeah, exactly. so I'm hoping now with Steven on board that we're going to get to do more of those types of things. And again, things like we talked about earlier with the typefaces and going making our own typefaces and really bringing in our brand and making it more ours. And I mean, he's got ideas and he's excited and he's a foodie, you know, and a cook himself, and he's a great illustrator. So I'm very excited to be working with him. I think he's going to do a lot, to help us kind of personalize the brand and especially grow these other ones as they start to develop. Cause I think having those two brains is always better than one.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to seeing some of that stuff. So as we're kind of wrapping up here, I want to hit you with, a few rapid fire questions, specifically about your food preferences things. And let's see where this goes.
You found my weak spot.
The first one is, what is kind of like your earliest food memory? It could be good or bad. It doesn't.
My earliest food memory of like a thing is actually, oregano, spaghetti and milk. And I hated oregano for so long. I still kind of despise it a little bit. I use it, but
when you say spaghetti and milk, you're talking like normal spaghetti and a glass of milk.
And I love spaghetti.
Right?
I mean, I'm a fat kid.
And a glass of milk, not like literally spaghetti.
Spaghetti and a glass of milk. So when I was young,
my family was the same way.
Distinct memory of food. Every meal, I had a glass of milk when I was young. Yep. When I was a little kid, mom poured you a glass of milk. So it was fall. We had a pecan tree out front. I had just been playing in the leaves, and some leaves had kind of gotten in my mouth. Ugh. And you know how that is. There's that. You'd made the face. That's the taste. Mm-hmm. And so I'd kind of spit them out, and I came back in. It was dinner, and I washed my hands like I'm told to. I go sit down, and I start shoveling spaghetti in my mouth, and that's fine. And I take a big old swig of milk. And it was almost vomit inducing to me. Like the flavor, it tasted so sour, so rancidly bad. I was just shook. And for years after that, I would try. And it took me a while and a little bit of experimentation before I figured out it was oregano. But in my head, I thought, oh, it must have been because I got these leaves in my mouth and there's something wrong with that. And it made the milk. No, it was oregano. Like she just went extra hard with the oregano and the spaghetti. And it wasn't something that, I think maybe the leaves may have just triggered that or
accentuated
because dry leaves taste like dirt and then, but also leaves. And then you get that oregano that's already kind of earthy and a little spicy. And then you get milk, which is like fatty and creamy and like, it was not a good combo. And so until about maybe I was in my 20s, if I had pasta, I just could not touch milk at all. And then I kind of started experimenting. I figured out if I didn't put oregano in it, I was okay.
I mean, I think once you're in your 20s, you can also make the judgment just to not have milk with spaghetti or
Right. Well, but sometimes you in your 20s also, like you're poor and you're like, I have milk. And I have mac and cheese.
Yeah. Sometimes you're so poor, you have to decide whether you want to drink the milk or make mac and cheese.
Yeah. So that was it. It's spaghetti and milk. But like for a long time, I was scared of milk too. Like, and it was a very roundabout story, but I was like, if I drink this. So now I always smell the milk and I'm like, is that sour? Is it? And it doesn't. It tastes fine. It's just, but I got paranoid after a couple of years of. Because my mom would be like, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. Just drink your milk.
Oh, I understand.
I'd begrudgingly drink it. So that's my first food memory.
Gotcha. What is kind of like your go-to comfort food?
White rice.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it has become my go-to comfort food. Like for reals. I've gotten really good at making it. Mm-hmm. And
do you do the first knuckle trick?
I do the first knuckle trick, man. I learned it. I did it. So there was an interesting article, or maybe it was a video, probably a video. And basically this guy showed that rice just needs a 1-to-1 of water. And so he did some rice in a sous vide and he vacuum sealed it, and put the right amount of like 1-to-1 water in it, it cooked perfectly. So that extra water is just for the evaporation, right? As it boils and steams. So I was trying to find the right measurement. And then finally I finally dialed it into about a cup of rice and a cup and a quarter of water. And then I just started like putting my finger in to see like how far that was. And then I realized, oh my God, I could just literally just pour this rice in and put the water in. And
yeah, doesn't matter how much rice you have.
First knuckle. That's it.
First knuckle.
That's all you need. And so, so now it's like, I love,
I learned rice. That from a, Filipino fraternity brother in college.
Well, yeah, I can imagine. God, I love Filipino food. Man, that stuff's bomb.
He couldn't cook anything but rice. I will say that.
I mean, rice is but so versatile.
He could do rice.
But I mean, I love mom's meatloaf. You know, I love spaghetti, even though I just had that horrible spaghetti milk story.
Sure.
I love lasagna. I love biscuits and gravy. I mean, again, I'm a fat kid. I love that kind of stuff. But
I know the feeling.
Rice is like, man, if I'm not feeling good, if I'm hungry, but I mean, I always have rice. I always have rice. I always have eggs and I always have beans. And,
yeah. Well, it's easy. It's not hard to digest. It's
no, you can make, you can just, make, you can rice with
add
dinner,
just about anything to it,
save the rest of it. And so this is what I do. I make rice. I fry up a couple of eggs, you know, with olive oil. I've been told they're Spanish eggs. I don't know if that's true or not, but you spoon the olive oil over them. They get real crispy on the edges and the olive oil cooks the top really fast. So it takes about a minute to a minute and a half. Then you slide them out on a bed of fresh rice and you break them up and that yolk gets all in there and you put some hot sauce on it. I mean, that's good eating. I don't know how to like, you know, get much more down and dirty than that comfort wise. You save the rest of your rice in a bag for the next day. You let it dry out a little bit and then you make fried rice and that's my jam. I love fried rice. I'd make it every day if I could. It's so good.
Please don't do that. You will have a heart attack at some point.
I will. So I don't, about once a week I make it for sure.
Yeah, that's acceptable. So yeah. What is your, what's your death row meal? That last meal you can ever have.
The last meal on earth before I go. It would probably be brisket. It'd probably be a brisket dinner.
Fatty or lean?
Fatty, always fatty. I just don't understand lean. I get it, I guess, from the, I just don't like the texture of fat, but the flavor, the meltiness of it, butteriness of it.
So I think people who don't like fat, I think a lot of people who don't like fatty, it's because of the word fatty.
Yeah, absolutely. But then the other word is moist. So it's like you can't yeah, win.
Exactly. And then people also hate the word moist. I was actually exactly the point I was going to make. Or B, they've had it where it's not cooked properly. Because if it's cooked properly, all that fat has broken down. It's not there anymore. It's just
it's like it's jelly butter.
All that's
it's
left is butter. The collagen that's holding it together so and stickiness. Good. And it's, yeah.
Well, I think that's, and I feel for those folks. It's hard. It's hard to get that brisket outside of, in my opinion, Texas. There are places throughout the South that do brisket correctly.
Yes.
It's just not as prevalent as in Texas, where I would say in Texas, it's a staple.
Yeah.
7 out of 10 barbecue joints probably going to do brisket right, maybe 6 out of 10. And in the South, and I'm going to include Oklahoma, even though we're in the Southwest, 1 out of 10 are going to do it right in terms of that fatty side, that point where it's at. But you're absolutely right. I mean, I've cooked steak for people that, you know, I go, what's your favorite steak? Filet mignon. The leanest cut you can get on a cow with the least amount of anything.
Yeah.
Filet mignon.
I mean, I like a good filet. Don't get me wrong.
I do too. But I love a ribeye.
Oh, yeah.
I love a ribeye. Mm-hmm. And when you tell people that, they're like, oh, that fat and that meat. Oh. And you're like, hold on. I got you. Let's slow roast this for like 45 minutes. Bring it up to about 130. And then we're going to pull it. We're going to rest it. And then we're going to sear it for a minute on each side. You're going to get this crusty, wonderful, meaty, you know, experience. And they're like, I don't know. And then I do it. And they lick the plate clean.
Yes.
They can't get enough. They're like getting bread, sopping up the juice and like getting all that fat goodness off of there.
And also don't eat the fat on the edge, because that's the hard fat that doesn't break down.
Yeah.
And don't eat
that off.
And don't eat the eye in the middle. Like,
exactly. Just that's there. You can't do anything about it. Don't eat that part. But the rest of that fat is, that's the magic sauce.
Yep.
Then if I couldn't have a brisket dinner, maybe I would enjoy some butter beer from the world of Harry Potter.
I've yet to try it. I've yet to make it down there since Harry Potter. Well, that's not true. I've been to Orlando since Harry Potter World opened. I just haven't been to Universal since it opened. So
I've only had bootleg butter beer, but if it's, I've been told it's good, but it's not even as good as butter beer. And I'm like, this bootleg stuff is awesome. So if it's that awesome, I would drown in that.
Yeah. The only reason I haven't been to Universal yet is because my kids were too young at that point to really get much use out of it. Now they're old enough where they can really enjoy roller coasters and stuff like that. So next trip we make, we're going to have to split it between Universal and the House of the Mouse.
Now, what about you, though? Like, what would your death row meal be?
My death row meal would be Lou Malnati's pizza with butter crust.
In Chicago?
Yes.
Malnati. Oh, my God. Malnati's so good.
Yes.
That's a great answer.
As a matter of fact, I am going to be having some Lou to go. You can order it mail order.
Oh, from Full Belly?
It is. No, I just ordered it off
Lou Malnati's. Oh, Malnati's Chips Now? Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. They've been doing it for years. But my folks ordered some. They're coming down for Christmas, so we're doing that Saturday night. I am looking forward to it. It is not as good as getting it in store.
As fresh, right.
But. It is an acceptable and lovely second place.
When was the first time you ever went to Malnati's? Do you remember?
No, I don't. Because, I was born in the Chicago area and lived there till I was 4. And then we moved to Minnesota, but all my cousins and all still lived there.
So you went back and visited.
So we went every year for Christmas.
Uh-huh.
Until I was in college. Yeah, in college.
So you, I was probably, you also familiar with Chicago barbecue, then we're going to talk about that.
I am not as familiar with Chicago barbecue.
I won't drag it out, but I want to talk to you about.
But I am familiar with it. We'll talk about that another time. I'll be honest. I am not as familiar with it because it's going to sound terrible. Actually, we'll talk about this afterwards.
But Malnati's is legendary.
Yes.
Good.
Yeah.
It's I was 17 on a trip to Chicago when we ate there and it blew my dang mind. It was, we ate that pizza for like 4 days.
Oh yeah.
We ordered a large.
Life.
We're like, yeah, we want a large pizza.
It's huge and it's huge. Thick and it's deep.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I think people don't like, you hear New Yorkers, you know, disparage Chicago style pizza.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think they understand there are two types of Chicago style pizza.
Yeah.
There's tavern style, which is a thin, crispy cracker style crust.
Yeah.
Remarkably similar to New York style, except for it's cut in squares.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Lou Malnati's. Chicago style deep dish, because
there's other places. I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah. I mean, Douay's is probably like the best, but there's only one location of that, and you have to go to downtown Chicago to get it. And you're going to stand in line for 2 hours to be able to get in there.
It's not worth it.
So Lou Malnati's has got locations all over the place in the greater Chicago area. You can get in there. You're still going to have to wait 30 minutes, but you can get in there. Anyways, you don't eat the Chicago style deep dish every day.
No, that's a treat.
That's a treat. That's a special occasion.
Yeah.
That
would make me
sick. You get that maybe once a month. Absolutely. Maybe once a month. And then the rest of the time when you want pizza. Point. Yeah. Well, that's pretty much how I am. Maybe twice a year.
Yeah. If you're lucky. If you're a good boy.
But you get the tavern style, your everyday pizza. And then you're good.
Well, honestly, New York, really for me, Brooklyn style pizza, like we've got a couple pizzerias down here. And
yeah, Brooklyn style is, there's, Brooklyn,
it's delicious, but like it's also like huge. And and I like the fresh cheesiness of it. I even like kind of some of the greasiness of it, but man, that's like an occasional thing. I like a thinner pizza with a little less on the top. And honestly, I find that
that's like Connecticut
that tavern style is where it's at, you know, that Christmas. I did just go to St. Louis this year on vacation, my first grown-up vacation ever. And we went and we had a St. Louis style pizza with Provel, which I had never had before. That was educational. And then we went to Ted Drew's frozen custard, which was also educational.
Yes.
Have you ever had gooey butter cake?
No, I have not had that. I've been to Ted Drew's, but I've never had gooey butter cake.
So I didn't realize this, but I didn't even know. Gooey butter cake is apparently a Midwestern staple.
Yeah, I know. I've heard of it since then, but I've never had it.
I've never had it either until I went there. And so they put a big old chunk of butter cake in the bottom. Then they put this custard on top, and then they drizzle it with this kind of buttery caramel sauce. And wow. I mean, it was just like overload. I mean, it took me about 2 hours to get through that thing. We had to go back to the Airbnb. I had to put it in the freezer. I had to relax a little bit. I had to go back to the freezer and get it out.
Get some pants with an elastic waistband.
I did. It was incredible. So yeah, that was the bomb.com. But man, yeah, I don't know why I didn't think of pizza. I love pizza.
Yeah, it's.
Are we going to get pizza when I come down to Creative South? Do you know any good pizza joints down there?
I don't know of any good. I mean, I don't live in.
We are going to get barbecue, though, right?
Yes, I told you about that. So
yeah, I've got the link saved before on my phone.
Before we wrap up, I'm going to announce this out there. When we go to Creative South this year, we are going to make a road trip, 45 minutes to the east or west. Yes, west, because you're heading into Alabama,
into the setting
to
sun.
Auburn, yeah. Alabama, to a barbecue place called Bow and Arrow. And it is, there's a restaurant in town called Acre, and the guy has been nominated for James Beard Best Chef in the South Award a few times now.
Dang.
And okay. I want to say that Acre won or was a semi, I don't know. He was like,
I mean, if you've been nominated several times, you've got to at least
several times.
Once.
So his sous chef was going to leave. Because he wanted to open a barbecue place. And being the smart chef that he is, he said, hey.
I'll bankroll it.
I'll bankroll it. Let's, not only that, let's go to this barbecue boot camp thing. I don't know which one it was, but it was like supposed to be the best one. It was, he's like, they went there and Aaron Franklin was like one of, not
it might have been down in Texas A&M. They have a meat.
It might have been. I don't
know. Over a weekend.
It might have been. He was, but Aaron Franklin was there so he could learn stuff, not as an instructor. Like, he's like, this is the place that I come every year to learn stuff, new stuff.
Oh, wow. Then maybe it wasn't the A&M thing.
It may have been. I don't know. I'm going
one
from.
One of these days, I'll get down there for a meat camp.
Yes. Oh, I really want to. But it is supposed to be every bit as good as if you take Texas style Franklin level barbecue and then you combine it with you get chicken that's Alabama style. So you've got Big Bob Gibson's. Yes. And then you get the South Carolina coastal vinegar style whole pork. Yeah. Whole hog barbecue.
Yeah.
And it's just supposed to be phenomenal. So I am willing to make a 45 minute drive for that.
I took your advice and I talked to, well, that's happening. We are going to do that for sure. I took your advice. I talked to Mike about a meetup. He says he might have a location in mind, but I was thinking if I could source, I know I can bring my smoker, and if I could source a couple others, we could do like a rib kind of a cookout where we have some ready to go. And then it's a bit of a Q&A, like, you know, prepping ribs, swapping recipes, just kind of smoking. Because, you know, you can smoke a rack of ribs you know, 3 hours or so if you cook hot and fast. And he was into the idea. So I hope we can make it come together. If not, he let me in a little bit of what you guys are planning. It sounds crazy.
You know more than I do.
it was like the barest hint. It was just like, I think he thought I was like, I want to do blah. And he's like, we're already planning a blah. And I'm like, no, not a blah, a blah.
Yeah.
So, but the blah that he's planning sounds legit. So there's hopefully going to be a lot of barbecue, a lot of hugs. I'm very much looking forward to doing bow and arrow with you. We didn't get to hook up last year. I was so sad.
Yeah, we saw each other in the lobby of the hotel like
twice.
There was a brief
man hug.
Yeah.
A soft caress, a gentle whisper, and then you were gone.
And then my wife got jealous.
what can I say? I'm huggable.
Yeah.
Squishable. Yep. That's going to be a blast. We should so 45 minutes definitely. Is not that far.
No, it's not bad at all. So
I'll bring my extra car seats. We'll load up.
I just pictured you putting like child car seats.
Oh, right. Some of these designers.
So this is what happens when you're a parent.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I finally got my third row of seats for my Yukon. So
nice.
I can put at least three grown people back there who don't mind being super intimate with each other.
That'll work. And well, Sean.
Probably smell good.
Yes. Hopefully. Sean, thank you so much for taking the time to do this again.
Oh my God, thank you.
I'm looking forward to seeing you up at Creative South, getting some barbecue. And in the meantime, go out and break some bread.
Break some bread. Let's do it.
You can find out more about Sean on Twitter at Inkstatic, and be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with him. I hope you liked this episode of Feasting on Design. Let me know what you think, and if you like it, leave me a review over on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Visit feastingondesign.com to catch up on the archives of the Creative South podcast. Get some cool swag like t-shirts and stickers that are on sale right now for 50% off with free shipping on orders over $25 when you use the code FREESHIPPING, all one word. Plus, you can keep up with the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Feast on Design, and I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram. Or you can check me out over on my website, ildisdesign.com.